Hey, this is Dave Douglas. I'm here with Michael Bates.
And this is A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast.
The Greenleaf Music Podcast is in your pocket and you're listening to it because you got it at iTunes or maybe you got it at greenleafmusic.com. But let us know what you're thinking. Send us an email, podcast@greenleafmusic.com.
Rate and review us at iTunes. We'd love to hear from you. Any particularly witty reviews?
That's right. You get free Greenleaf stuff. It's been authorized by the higher authorities at Greenleaf. So this is kind of an unusual episode for us. We're talking to a,
invertebrate zoologist.
Right. And he works a lot in genomics. And we're going to talk a lot about different concepts that he's working on and imagining. And Apurva Narachania is going to be here with us for an interview, so we hope you enjoy it.
No. Mother. To be and no father.
Apurva, it's Michael Bates and Dave Douglas calling from A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast.
Hey, it's nice to make your acquaintance, Dave.
Likewise.
So we're very excited about speaking with you about all these wild topics. Before we get going, though, you know, since you're our resident smart guy, could you give me like a brief bio?
Yeah, sure. Right now I'm at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. Over here, we pretty much do anything that is based in evolution. So all we really, really care about is building evolutionary trees to see how all living things and how some extinct things are related. That can extend anywhere from analyzing fossils and bones to analyzing genome signatures and DNA sequences. So it's all the same kind of information that goes into the same matrices that we use to develop these phylogenetic trees and say how one thing is related to another living thing. And like, and we do all kinds of different organisms. And that's one of the things that's really cool about working here is that, you know, usually if you work in a medical research laboratory or a big research institution, everything's based in human or it's based in model organisms like fruit flies or C. elegans or worms or, you know, stuff like that. But over here, researchers are interested in anything and everything. For example, we do a lot of stuff on leeches because we're interested in the anticoagulative properties of some of their substances that they secrete. We do a lot of stuff on stalk-eyed flies, which are like flies that have eyes on the end of stalks because it's interesting in terms of sexual selection. We do a lot of stuff on, like, for example, venomous snails just because they're the most venomous things in the world. So it's all over the map, you know, bioluminescence, anything that's interesting, but not necessarily relevant. You know, so all kinds of stuff, you know, pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking to two basically, what's the word, jazz musicians about this stuff. And aside from the fact that I want to mention, I did play in a band called Venomous Snails back in the 80s.
Did?
Yeah, in the 80s. But like, so you, when you're saying that this is not, the research that you're doing is, it's not specific to the medical community. So, like a lot of the topics that I've read that you're involved in are, you know, they're more about exploration, really, right?
Exactly. Yeah, about exploring the unknown. I mean, like, and there's very little, I mean, for me, there's a lot that comes out of exploring something like that. You know, like, just to know something is, you know, or that you can know it is very exciting to me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're not going to necessarily turn a profit on any of these things.
Well, right. Like, one of the topics you were mentioning was trying to discover the color of dinosaurs.
That's a brand new topic for me, so I really can't speak very kind of knowledgeably about that one yet. But it's based on the fossil record. Mm-hmm. And kind of the way that a certain kind of cell called a melanosome is kind of preserved in fossils. So a melanosome is usually what gives an organism its color. Hmm. And what they found is that they're now able to actually see something in these melanosomes. And I don't, I'm not well versed enough yet to really speak about that one yet.
So I don't want to talk about dinosaurs at all. I want to talk about this algorithm that you've designed to cluster genes using swarm behavior.
Oh, that's the emergence property.
Yeah. So I'd like to hear about this. So this is something that you're currently working on, right?
Yeah. So this has been my 1 year old baby at this point. And like, it does take that long to generate a piece of academic software because you're working on a million different things. So the idea there is to, you know, look to nature for inspiration as to how to cluster things that you wouldn't expect to be able to cluster. So, one of the most beautiful things that you can see in nature is the way, prey organisms actually elude predator organisms, right? So some of them do it by feed, you know, but most of them actually do it in groups in order to kind of confuse the predators. So, if you see, for example, a shoal of fish underwater or a school of fish, like, you know, when they move and they sparkle and they glisten in this amazing way, I mean, like, they're all moving in a coordinated way that no single entity can kind of, like, project, but they're all doing collectively, right? Blackbirds do the same thing when trying to elude hawks. And the really cool thing there is that, like, a single individual within that flock is only monitoring individuals within a certain radius.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So maybe they'll look about one or two deep, right? You can kind of envision the whole thing as kind of a three-dimensional domino set or something like that, where, you know, there's kind of an impulse on one edge of the flock. And depending on how strong that impulse is, it kind of radiates through the rest in this very fluid way. And the whole thing will kind of move in a very kind of, I don't know, it's just so beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
That kind of thing is actually very simple to model because each of the automatons is very, it's very simple. It's actually only responding to its immediate vicinity. Mm-hmm. And it's only doing, you know, one of three things, which is like, it's either aligning itself to its flock mates, right? So it's actually, they're all flying in the same direction and they all want to have the same kind of center of mass. Okay. So they're all flying to the same point. None of them want to actually run over each other. So there's kind of a separation. So if you take those three kind of what we call vectors into consideration, then you can actually model every single movement within that cluster. So if you take those three things and you actually code them up, and then you can actually, instead of thinking of those things as birds or fish, you can think of them as genes. And as long as you know the distance between two genes in terms of, and we always think in terms of evolutionary distance. So if two genes have the same evolutionary history, they'd have a smaller distance.
Mm-hmm.
If two genes have a further evolutionary history, then they have a larger distance. So, as long as you know that distance, you can kind of model whether two genes will like each other in a flock or if they won't like each other in a flock. So that's the kind of thing that I've been working on lately. And the thing that's a really cool thing there is that you're kind of thinking about this. You're bringing like another biological principle to studying a different kind of biological principle. If you understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then you can also apply all of that behavior to all sorts of different situations. Like you were saying, describing the way the human brain works, for example, using this. I guess you'd call it emergence.
Yeah. So emergence is kind of a blanket term, and you know, a lot of people like to use that term, and you know, some people actually shy away from it because, you know, it's kind of a magic term, right? So, Like, if you don't quite understand how something works, you can call it an emergent property and get away with it.
That's good to know. Thanks, Wade. Let me write that down. That was a really emergent solo.
Obviously, the human brain is finite, right? I mean, there's a number of neurons, and they're connected in a myriad ways. I mean, it's just crazy the amount of complexity. But since there is a finite number of neurons, there are these basic connections which people can actually see, right? And map. But like human intelligence is kind of emergent from those kind of physical connections, and nobody knows what the step is from those physical connections and those neural nets to human intelligence. So that could be considered like an emergent property. Like another example that I think I mentioned to you guys was social insects. Like this is where this kind of concept of emergence really stood on its two feet in the history of science. Like E.O. Wilson, with his pioneering work on social insects, kind of introduced this concept of emergence, where no single ant really knows what it's doing, right? And if you catalog the behaviors of ants, mm-hmm. like they only do about 15 things, right? I mean, they kind of forage, they take care of their young,
carry stuff.
They execute defense. So they do very, very few actual discrete behaviors. Mm-hmm. But overall, collectively, the colony kind of exhibits a direction and a purpose which no single individual does. So, I mean, that's another example of emergence, and it's kind of hard to explain why all those pieces put together kind of leads to this kind of cohesive whole, but it does.
Very interesting, because I think, the applications to the kind of music that we play.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking the whole time.
The way that a group improvises together, you could put, you use the word vectors, you could think of it that way.
Sure, I can see that too. Yeah, that makes sense.
So talk a little bit about this this information overload idea and finding new ways to store our increasingly large repositories of information.
This is a huge question, and I think a lot of industries are facing it, and a lot of like areas of study. One of the really, really cool developments lately is that like DNA itself. And this is the thing I was talking to Michael about when we first started talking about doing this. This is really fascinating. Is that DNA by its essence, like it basically packs 4 gigabases of information into a microscopic cell, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And not even the cell; it packs it into the nucleus. So, there is no more information dense kind of media available to us that we know of. Nothing that we've created has come that close. And what's really, really attractive about it is that DNA is designed to operate at ambient temperatures, right? So you don't have to freeze it, and you don't have to put it in any kind of cryostasis or anything like that.
But do you have to keep it alive, don't you? I mean, isn't it, or no, you don't?
Well, actually, you don't necessarily have to keep it alive, as long as you code it as sequence, and then you can crystallize that DNA, and then you can store the DNA. And that crystallized DNA can actually exist at room temperatures. It'll do better. It'll do better in the cold, but you can keep it at room temperature and then actually access that DNA whenever you want it. And that DNA can code any kind of information, right, as long as you have the code. and you'd have to design a primer, which is what some people have actually done. The bases A, C, T, and G would represent, you know, various things in a binary code, right? Like zeros and ones. And you can code, you know, movies, or you can code very, very large files in that way. Write it as DNA, synthesize that DNA, store it, and then when you're ready to access it, sequence that DNA.
Well, so, I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you say synthesize that as DNA, yeah. You're turning it into something that exists at that point, or is it still code?
No, you're turning it into something that exists. So you're
Which is like an arm, or
like a red dinosaur.
No, you're actually creating a polymer, right? So a DNA is a polymer, right? So you're creating the DNA string, and you're doing it many, many, many times over, right? So
yeah.
So you're creating these kind of DNA crystals that you can actually put into a vial, and that vial would then represent whatever information that you try to encode.
Your entire movie collection, for example, to
people. And it would be like. several thousand of our movie collections. Like, I mean, it would be hundreds of thousands of people's movie collections in one vial. Like, I mean, that's how dense the information could be. Like, this is the ultimate glacial storage, right? I mean, like, it's actually really, at this point, it's really difficult to encode DNA and then decode DNA, right? Because the sequencing is getting better, and the encoding process, which is kind of creating the DNA, is getting better. But both of those things are still relatively costly compared to kind of writing it on a magnetic disk drive, for example. Because it can handle so much data, the cost curve is such that, like, it's becoming more and more reasonable to at least put, the stuff that we want to archive for the long term.
Yeah, that you may never use, but kind of, it needs to be there.
Right, exactly, into this kind of DNA medium. So, I mean, it's kind of still brand new, and, like, you know, the big articles on this came out last year, so... it'll still be, you know, several years before it becomes... kind of a reasonable thing to do.
Okay, so this is all about information storage, right? And we used to put stuff on like notepads and files, and then we had floppy disks. And I have a bunch of music that I had on floppy disks back in the day, which is now, you know, I could take it to the Smithsonian and get the information off, I suppose. But they're basically useless, right? So then every couple of years, I'm sure there's some other law that talks about, you know, information storage and how everything's becoming obsolete so quickly. So, you know, the hard drives that we keep a lot of our stuff on now, 5 years from now, may not hook into any computer system that we have. And you know, you're talking about storing, you know, massive amounts of information about our experience as humans. And, you know, hopefully that many years from now, that information will still be relevant, yeah, you know, accessible, right?
Yeah, and also have some bearing on, you know, history.
So is that what you think the storage medium is really about? Like, this will be something that will be accessible for many generations?
Yeah, I mean, that would be the ideal. But I want to emphasize that this is it's really highly experimental. Nobody's really trying to do this on a large scale. Mm-hmm. People have proven that it's possible at this point.
I see.
So it's kind of like bleeding edge stuff that nobody is really using. Like right now, I mean, people are using the cloud for all the reasons that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to be caught with an old piece of hardware.
Right.
So rather than, you know, like rather than running around with floppy drives, or rather than running around with a hard disk. People just upload it to Dropbox and let Dropbox deal with the fact that they have to constantly update their hardware.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So that's one of the main things that the cloud does for people, is it kind of commodifies, you know, the hardware problem, and we don't necessarily have to deal with that, which I think is a big advance. But this is completely different. I mean, this is still many, many, many years into the future.
Right, and I guess, you know, the NSA would probably have equal access to any DNA storage methods that do come along.
Right, unless you bury it into your backyard or something like that. And don't tell anybody.
Under your mattress.
Yeah, don't dig up there. There's a polymer under there. There's two different things that you were talking about, and I wonder if they're related. One is the exoplanets, and the other is the, you know, how the search for extrasolar planets is taking place. Are those?
Yeah. So that's like that goes into the journalism that I like to do. Obviously, like with the paleontologists, like I don't know anything about what they're doing. I'm a scientist that's going into a completely different kind of science mm-hmm. when I step into their world. And the guy that I actually tailed when I did this is a guy named Ben Oppenheimer, and he's a curator here at the museum. And you know, his work is fascinating to me because you know, one of the things that has always kind of puzzled me, and one of the most amazing questions in science is, you know, what was that first life form like, right? Mm-hmm. And what was it exactly? Because Darwinian evolution can tell you everything about what happened after that first point, right? I mean, like, natural selection is a really, really cool theory, but it only works for after you have that first form of life. So, you know, before that, like, you know, it doesn't have anything to say, right? So,
yeah.
So, and that's where, you know, kind of religion can still step in, right? They can say that, you know, if this planet was seeded, and, you know, natural selection was, you know, everything since then. There are a lot of scientists that wouldn't believe that. There's a whole field called prebiotic evolution, which I don't know much about, but there's people
exists.
Working on, like, yeah,
but is that a science that it would be specific to Earth, or would they be looking for something more universal to the, you know?
Right. So, yeah, that's exactly why I brought it up. So the thing about the geological and biological history of this planet is that it's largely erased, you know, the further and further you go back. Because this is such a dynamic place. I mean, like, you know, with wind, water, and geological activity, like, it's really, really hard to kind of, you know, trace the natural history of this planet to those very, very, very early moments. So people like Ben, you know, their idea is to actually look, you know, heavenward for answers of that type. Because, you know, now with the Kepler satellite kind of looking at a very, very small section of our Milky Way galaxy has confirmed that most stars, have at least a couple planets. And, you know, several, and, like, you know, many, many stars are going to have Earth-like planets that are rocky, that don't necessarily have liquid water, but might have you know, other hospitable qualities.
So how far away do you think they are from actually finding an inhabited planet?
my guess is never. I mean, like,
really?
I don't think you'll ever be able to say with certainty.
Huh.
Maybe Ben would take exception to that. I don't know, but like, it would be kind of a numbers game, right? Because like, you would see what the atmospheric constituents are, right. And then you could see, like, you know, this is very, very, very much like an Earth-like planet, but unless you can actually visit the place, or unless you get a signal to the place, or a signal from the place.
Right.
I mean, that said, I mean, like, one of the main things that I asked these guys was, you know, it's, everybody talks about life as we know it, because we can't conceive of life in any other way.
Right.
But there's no reason life has to be, you know, carbon-based in an oxygen atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
based in an aqueous solution. Like, it could be completely different. You know, all it has to do is, you know, be able to self-organize and reproduce itself. And you know, that could happen in various other media that we're not even considering.
Like a polymer, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like a silicon-based organism.
Or right. Whatever. We could be, right? Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean,
okay, so we have to go, but I feel like we're not even brushing the surface here.
Well, it's also the wonder element of it is what I think, you know, coincides with a lot of the way that we think about music in composing
right.
and improvising and playing. So it's great to hear all of this. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to you soon. I gotta be honest, I'm not sure how much of that I understood.
I mean, you know, in the words of Mark Twain, it's better to stay silent and seem to be ignorant than to open one's mouth and remove all doubt. Narachania is the very, very inspiring.
Yeah.
Very amazing.
From the lips of Dave Douglas.
It's Mark Twain.
But from the lips of Dave Douglas. Hey, can I ask you a couple of questions about music?
Sure.
So I recently picked up the set of scores from all your quartet records.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask about Rob Ford again. Yeah.
No, I'm not going to ask about Rob Ford.
Okay.
Rob Ford is dead to me.
It's no good. No, okay. No, but I did put out all the charts from Magic Triangle and Leap of Faith.
Yeah, and I recently picked them up. A tune that has always intrigued me from the album Leap of Faith is the song called Millennium Bug.
Mm-hmm.
And I was checking out the chart and looking at it and wanted to ask you some questions about it.
Oh, okay.
Y2K. I got the title, the title reference written in 1999, Millennium Bug. And it's, you know, it's an interesting piece. Maybe we'll listen to a little bit right now.
Okay.
Okay, so
right. Ben Porowski, James Genus, and Chris Potter.
And to me, the tune really revolves around like kind of a special thing that Ben does really well,
mm-hmm.
and that's sort of the drums and bass and that kind of groove. So when you were writing the tune, is that
what you were hearing immediately? Is that like the instructions say straight hi-hat and backbeat and that's it? Yeah. So is it something that Ben kind of added to the mix?
Well, I wrote it for the band knowing that it was Ben and he does that. And sometimes other tunes would go to that place. You know, when we were touring a fair amount. And so I would hear people do things and then it would influence what I was writing.
Sure.
I think I was also trying to write with that band, you know, simple structures and frameworks where we could really, you know, go free of constraints, take the handcuffs off, but, you know, have material that really was suggestive of something. But when I make my charts, I really try not to write. Like, maybe on the original handwritten chart, I might have written drum and bass feel.
Oh, okay.
But I really try to avoid making a stylistic reference.
Right.
So that's why in this case I wrote straight eighths, hi-hat, and backbeat. Right. So that's like what instruments you play it on and where.
Right.
Rather than boogaloo or some kind of weird genre.
So type. And so the tune is just really a series of phrases like that are different lengths. It's kind of got this hemiola thing where you have, you know, dotted half notes kind of floating over the bar line, which adds to sort of like the different layers. And then in terms of the harmony, what do you think?
You know, the whole rationale of the writing for the quartet was to try to find with the three melodic voices as full a harmony as I could.
I see.
So most of the charts don't have chord symbols. And it's just trumpet, tenor, and bass parts.
And were the second horn line, was that written at the same time as the basic melody, or was this something that was harmonized after the fact?
I would say it was probably different every time.
Really?
I try not to get into a pattern of using a process in any predictable way.
Right.
I would think in the case of this tune. I probably wrote the two horn parts simultaneously, but there are some independent moving parts.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, you know, trying to not always use the bass as the root of a chord or the bottom
for sure.
of a, you know, try to find a way to make some chords where the bass note is actually an additional melodic voice.
Right, right.
And then it makes it like the function of an inversion.
Yeah. So more of a linear
so it's
kind
like
of approach.
Not the root of the chord on the bottom. Yeah, and very linear. And John Zorn in the interview that we did said that really interesting thing about being a composer, that he thinks of it like being a catalyst. You know, you try to create a situation, create a vibe, create an atmosphere where people can do what they do.
Right.
And
when you were touring with this band and this tune, would it go to similar places nightly, or would it be a different thing? Like, would it end up with that groove? It's really curious.
You know, again, every tune is different. I think that on this one, it did go to different places. I probably initially imagined this as a drum feature type tune, and yet on the recording, you know, there are horn solos.
Yeah.
So it did change up. And with that band, we had the opportunity to be on the road trying things out and trying things different ways. So when we got in the studio, we sort of settled on something, a way that it should be.
Great tune, Dave. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. So should we call Drummond or should we wrap it up?
Let's wrap it up.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Drummond. And A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. Greenleafmusic.com is where you would find more information.
Podcast@greenleafmusic.com is where you can write us.
iTunes is where you can additionally subscribe to said podcast. And by leaving us a
comment
or a review, you could not only win free stuff, but you'll also be helping to spread the music. And we appreciate your support and all of you who are listening.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right.